Good evening, everybody. Hi. Welcome to Modern Poets at the Museum of Modern Art. My name is Laura Bayless, and I'm just delighted that you have all joined us for tonight's program, which is called The Adventures of Crazy Cat, which is presented together with the Paris Review. I'd like to thank the Contemporary Arts Council of the Museum of Modern Art for their support of this series. As some of you may know, Modern Poet seeks to bring poetry and literature to MoMA's collection, fostering the age-old collaboration between writers and visual artists. Tonight's program on Crazy Cat came about after the Paris Review had generously given me a number of its recent issues in the summer of 2007. I found Monica Yoon's brilliant poems on Ignat's mouse within that summer's issue, and knowing that Crazy Cat had taken to the screen at MoMA before, and that Crazy Cat had inspired countless artists, writers, and filmmakers from Picasso to E.E. Cummings to Gregory LaCava, I pursued this poetry meets film meets comic strip idea. And with the great collaboration of the Paris Review, this is the first time that Modern Poets has asked artists and critics from these distinct disciplines to come together. I look forward to hearing them as they share their thoughts on Crazy Cat and Ignat's Mouse, and how stories are told and retold through the years and in different media. Our remarkable participants tonight are film critic Jim Hoberman, poet Monica Yoon, and poet, critic, and co-poetry editor of the Paris Review, Megan O'Rourke. And now to give you a little bit of background on each of them. Jim Hoberman is the senior film critic at The Village Voice and an adjunct professor of cinema studies at the Cooper Union. He has written for Art Forum, the London Review of Books, and the New York Times. His books include The Dream Life, Movies, Media, and the Mythology of the 60s, The Red Atlantis, Communist Culture in the Absence of Communism, and On Jack Smith's Flaming Creatures. Megan O'Rourke's first book of poems, Half-Life, was published by W.W. Norton in 2007. She is the literary editor of Slate and a poetry editor at the Paris Review, and her poems and essays have appeared in the New Yorker, the New Republic, Poetry, the Kenyon Review, and other venues. She is the recipient of the 2005 Union League and Civic Arts Foundation Award from Poetry Magazine and of a Front Page Award for her criticism. Monica Yoon is the author of Barter from 2003 and Ignatz, forthcoming from Four Way Books in 2010. She has been awarded a 2008 Witter Binner Poetry Fellowship from the Library of Congress and a 2008 Bellagio Residency from the Rockefeller Foundation, as well as a Wallace Stegner Fellowship from Stanford University. She has published poems in numerous journals and anthologies, including the Paris Review and the Norton Anthology of Contemporary Voices from the East, and her political reporting has appeared in Slate. She is an attorney at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, focusing on election law and campaign finance reform issues, and has taught creative writing at Columbia University and Pratt Institute. Thank you to Monica, Jim, and Megan, and thanks to all of you for coming and sharing your enthusiasm for art and poetry. Please join us afterwards for some wine after the program in the Bartos lobby right outside of the theater, where the Paris Review will be selling some of its publications. So without further ado, I just want to outline briefly what the format for tonight's program will be. Jim is going to present first on the impact of Crazy Cat on the comic strip. Then Monica will read some of her poems on Ignatz, and then Megan will moderate a conversation here on stage. So thank you all, and enjoy the program.
Hi. We can start with that. Crazy Cat is a unique entity. A unique creature, that's Crazy Cat there. Gilbert Seldes' pioneering 1924 appreciation, which appeared in the original Vanity Fair, had the punning title, The Crazy Cat That Walks By Himself. And Seldes wrote that of all the lively arts, the comic strip is the most despised. And yet, George Harriman's daily strip, Crazy Cat, struck him as the most amusing and fantastic and satisfactory work of art produced in America today. Seldes was not only a fan, he was a kind of missionary of Crazy Cat who enjoyed turning his friends on to this comic strip, including F. Scott Fitzgerald, Edmund Wilson, and even James Joyce. Crazy Cat was invented a bit more than a decade into the history of the newspaper comic strip. First newspaper comic strips were a product of the circulation war in New York at the end of the 19th century. Crazy Cat erupted out of literally out of a strip that Harriman was working on called The Family Upstairs. The family upstairs was never in the strip. It was actually the Dingbat family downstairs who was suffering, you know, from what was going on upstairs. But what he began doing was introducing some creatures sort of under the floor, a cat and a mouse, and they took on a life of their own around 1913 and got their own strip, which ran for 30 years until its creator's death in 1944. Harriman once said of Crazy Cat that Crazy Cat was not conceived, not born, it just grew. And that's one way to describe what is certainly the greatest of comic strips. Crazy Cat is brilliantly formulaic. It's based on an eternal triangle and a single situation. You have a cat of indeterminate but most likely female gender who loves a mouse and is in turn adored by a dog. The mouse hates the cat and, in fact, likes nothing more than creasing the cat's bean with a brick. This is interpreted by our crazy cat as proof that the mouse, whose name is Ignatz, truly cares. And, in fact, for Crazy Cat, Ignatz is a little angel. After each hurled brick, the dog, Officer Pup, jails Ignatz as punishment for this assault on his beloved cat. He's very protective, not that Crazy cares. E. Cummings was another fan, wrote the introduction to an anthology of Crazy Cat strips, which was one of the first, maybe the first, anthology of newspaper strips to be published in hardcover. This was in 1946, 2 years after the strip ended. And Cummings wrote that in contrast to the cynical brick-throwing mouse and the sentimental police dog, a crazy cat was humbly poetic, gently clown-like, supremely innocent, and illimitably affectionate creature. There are no limits. Every day, including Sunday, there was the strip appeared a single situation with countless variations. There's one early one. Some of them are pretty baroque. In this one, you can see that Officer Pup is tricked into throwing the brick. It's odd here that Crazy is kind of scolding Ignatz. It seems a little bit out of character. But in any case, the end is the same, and with the brick suspended over Crazy's head. And Ignatz approves of that. Here's another situation. This much more complicated, a Sunday page, and basically what's happening is Ignatz is spooked by an echo He doesn't know what it is at the end of the, and so are all the other animals in Coconino County, spooked by an echo, which is to say a repetition, which is something that is crucial to the crazy cat cosmos. Crazy cat never ducks, never eludes the brick, and neither did the strip itself ever duck the violence inherent in the term punchline. Which ended each strip. It's important to point out that Crazy Cat is not just a contemporary, but a kind of slight precursor of the great slapstick comics of the movies. Chaplin came to the United States in 1914, and that was just months after the Crazy Cat comic strip was instituted. And like Chaplin, Crazy Cat synthesizes a particular mixture of sweetness and slapstick, playful fantasy and emotional brutality. The strip acknowledges life's school of hard knocks and then negates it. The quintessential image is Ignatz crowning Crazy with a brick, and this trajectory is, you can see down, there is marked with a zip or a pow or sometimes a bop as the missile bounces upwards off the back of Crazy's head. It's as visceral, I think, as a drawing can get, and often you see the monomaniacal mouse into a kind of Walter Johnson follow through as he's hurled the brick. Crazy is knocked forward at a 45-degree angle by the force of the blow. Never a bump is raised, but as Crazy pitches towards the earth, a dotted line will appear, not in this one, but we'll see it. A dotted line may appear, culminating in a little heart, that issues from the cat's forehead. Here, after this long, this kind of convoluted adventure where all the animals are frightened, it doesn't seem as like the brick is ever going to be hurled, and Ignatz has to go back and look up echo in the dictionary to understand what it is, and then goes and gets his brick and is able to throw it, and the force of the impact is felt, and Crazy says, "Ah, at last, my darling is here." Throughout, this violence is just subsumed by the cat's charming personality, Crazy's romantic optimism, philosophical ramblings. There's an amiable propensity for ukulele-accompanied song. The cat has a unique patois, sort of a stage Yiddish accent tempered with miscellaneous Sam Wellerisms and things that were invented by Harriman. I should say that let's look now. This is one of the rare strips where Ignatz is thwarted. A Sunday strip from the 20s when there was a color, although Harriman did not have the same freedom to invent the panels as he did earlier. Cummings said that Harriman's drawings resembled a child's drawing of a cat, albeit a cat gifted with the secret grace and obvious clumsiness of a penguin on terra firma. Harriman's characterizations are really masterpieces of dramatic economy. I mean, he's able to individuate these characters through their body language and through things that are not there. I mean, Ignatz has no mouth. You'll see, but because of that, his eyes, these little dots, are almost preternaturally alert in an otherwise blank face. Harriman's line is almost free associational in its spontaneity, looks like inspired doodling, and the spirit of this craziness governs every aspect of the setting, Coconino County, which is a real place in Arizona, near Monument Valley, And the formula of the strip is counterpointed by this delirious, insistent flux. The logo is mutable from day to day. The panels regularly alternate between day and night. And the landscape itself is very fluid. The layouts, too. You can see here that we go to night. There's pyramids there, but then it could be the Rock of Gibraltar. Above that, this looks like chimney rock in Arizona. I mean, it's characteristic of Harriman's world. We can see that here and also in the next strip. Okay, Crazy Cat also has its own sort of vulgar modernism. It's full of self-referential gags, particularly during its final decade. There are references within the strip to the fact that it's a strip, although it's fairly subtle. But the creatures can be aware of themselves as being made of print and ink. And so here you have Crazy going to a beauty saloon and gets a bath, and so comes out. The black ink has been washed away, and Crazy's kind of like a ghost. What's striking is that Ignatz doesn't recognize the cat. In fact, he almost falls in love with this white beauty who's striding out of the salon. And there's perhaps another meaning in this as well. Harriman was born in 1880 in New Orleans, and from a Creole family of colored Creoles. A contemporary of Jelly Roll Morton, a few years older, and a similar background. And this puts Harriman, Crazy Cat, locates them not only in the close to the world of slapstick comedy, which was the great popular American visual form of the teens and twenties, but also jazz. He comes from the birthplace of jazz, and there's a sense in which the entire strip is just is a riff that's varied on for 30 years. His family relocated to Los Angeles when he was 6 years old. Didn't really grow up in New Orleans. And then he came east, and he passed for white. Although if you're aware of his history, people are always, oh, he was Greek, he was this, he was that. I mean, there's always an issue. What was he? It's also a story that he was always photographed wearing a hat, to make that part of his identity as well. The strip was not tremendously popular. I mean, R. Crumb referred to Harriman as the Da Vinci of the comic strip, and I'm not going to argue with that. But basically, Crazy Cat survived for 30 years only because William Randolph Hearst liked it. Hearst was his patron. So it's kind of an aristocratic throwback. Hearst owned the newspapers, and so Crazy Cat could continue for Harriman's lifetime. When Harriman died in 1944, the strip was only syndicated in 35 newspapers. I mean, something like Blondie was syndicated in 1,000 newspapers. So you can see that it was a minority taste. Also, comic strips were to a degree eternal, that, if the creator died and then somebody else could continue it. But there was no question that anybody other than Harriman could ever draw a Crazy Cat. He was, however, immediately recognized, or soon recognized, as belonging to another world. In his essay, Seldes compares him to Rousseau. Some years ago, during the High and Low show that was at this museum, there were some Crazy Cat pages that were juxtaposed with some Miró paintings from the 30s, Dog Barking at the Moon would be one. Other fans included Willem de Kooning and Philip Guston. I mentioned E. Cummings, Jack Kerouac, and Ishmael Reed, who dedicated his novel Mumbo Jumbo to Harriman, and actually picked up on Harriman's statement that Crazy Cat just grew, and turned that into a kind of manifesto. Novelist Jay Cantor wrote a book in the 80s in which Crazy Cat is kind of like the embodiment of modern times, and I think that what's compelling about Harriman, or that something that I wouldn't want to forget, is that he's also a journalist. He has to do this every single day. He has to come up every single day with an idea, with a variation on this. For the most disposable of you know, venues, something which is thrown away each day afterwards. So this is this ephemeral nature of the strip is part of it, and he brought something to journalism as well. There was a once well known column in the New York Sun, Archie and Mehitabel, about a cat and a cockroach. The cockroach would write the column, you know, with all lowercase, like E. Cummings, because he couldn't reach the thing. And Harriman illustrated this, and in a way, he midwifed that as well. So there were Crazy Cat movies. Hearst had a studio, and so of course he would have wanted to maximize his investment, such as it was. So there were some movies produced in the teens, then again in the 20s, and in the 30s, and finally in the 60s for TV. Each of these cycles getting further from the original Cat. But I thought maybe we could look at an example from the first Crazy Cat cartoons, because it's not the same as the comic strip, but it has its elements too. This was made in 1916, the one that we're going to see. Okay, so there's kind of a different dynamic there. You know, crazy's been a little normalized, not as dreamy as in the comic strip. However, it's interesting to see that, because Harriman essentially invented the funny animal comic strip with Crazy Cat, and even this cartoon was itself a precursor or an influence on Felix the Cat, who started as an animated creature and was the second biggest star in Hollywood after Chaplin in the 20s, and Mickey Mouse, who then became the biggest star in the world when sound came in. And well, let's go to the... Okay. The essential Crazy Cat. And, you know, other funny animal strips, you know, Mickey Mouse and Felix both went back into newsprint, and you know, the funny animal strip encompasses Fritz the Cat and even Art Spiegelman's Mouse. In terms of comics, Crazy Cat offered a self-contained world with an elementary cast, and so the two most highly regarded strips of the 50s and 60s, that is Walt Kelly's Pogo, where you have these poetical animals in Okefenokee Swamp, and especially Charles Schulz's Peanuts, are descendants of Crazy Cat, and as remarkable and admirable as they are, these scripts, I think, by comparison, have a certain heaviness. I mean, they can become overly familiar, even tired. But Harriman repeated the same gag every day for about 10,000 days. And what he did was essentially unrepeatable. And that's this comic strip.
Thanks so much, Jim, and thank you, Laura and Megan. So I'm right. I have written a book of poems, not 10,000 poems, as in the repetition of the gag, but probably 40 or 50 some poems that are just all based on the mouse character, Ignatz, and the book will be called Ignatz, and it's coming out in 2010. And it's a very, very loose rendition of this, or it's inspired by this strip rather than trying to be a direct translation or rendering of it. So, for instance, in the way I'm putting it forward, Ignatz is not necessarily a mouse. Crazy is not necessarily a cat. It's more just kind of an exploration of these themes and what happens when you have repeated the same thing too many times. So the book is structured in four sections, and each one starts off with a little song, which is in the voice of Crazy. So you can imagine a little ukulele. Oh, Ignatz, won't you meet me by the blue bean bush, robed in the loveliest robe of the year? Five ripe dewberries on a sweet gum leaf, a dark red love knot in my short black hair. Oh, Ignatz, won't you play me like a filigree flute? I'll trill any tune it might please you to hear. Oh, sweet Adeline, oh, clair de la lune, your song my only voice, your breath my only air. Oh, Ignatz, won't you dress me in your lead-lined coat, proof against passion, resistant to tears? I'll stroll through the streets with a safeguarded strut, set up shop in the kissing booth, buyer beware. Oh, Ignatz, won't you flee into the wither-wander woods, find a hidey-hole until the coast is clear, a silver-leafed bower of shivering shade, I will weave you a shelter of my living hair. Ignatz invoked. A gauze bandage wraps the land and is unwound, stained orange with sulfates. A series of slaps molds a mountain. A fear uncoils itself, testing its long, cool limbs. A passing cloud seizes up like a carburetor and falls to earth, lies broken-backed and lidless in the scree. Acetylene torches now snug in their holsters, shotbacks trundled back behind the dawn. A mist becomes a murmur, becomes a moan rising from the fissures in the rocks. Oh, pity us, Ignatz. Oh, come to us by moonlight. Oh, arch your speckled body over the earth. An obad is a little morning love song, which is usually done. It's kind of a, I don't want to leave you. It's so nice lying here in bed with you, but I've got to get up and start the day. Ignatz obad. Star maps of broken capillaries, crown of infrared, song of drifting dune. The smooth, bold trees of his interior, blossoming and unblossoming. I spent 6 days almost touching you. Here's a one where the title reads into the poem. At the free clinic, Ignatz snoozes with his head down on the secondhand classroom desk, with his elbow on the part of it that curves around to support his elbow, so that he can shut his eyes against the bend of his own arm, with his cheek pressed against the laminated desktop, and his fingers just draping over the laminated plywood edge that is the same edge that curves around to dig slightly into his ribcage, which is tilted so his lowered spine stays in contact with the molded contours of the glossy sea-green chair that curves around to where his thighs begin and rises slightly just where his legs need to rise and rounds off gently and ends just where his legs need to bend down to the floor, so that if this is a lesson in how something harder and something softer can achieve a mutuality, if the harder thing has a curvature that suggests an accommodating mindset and the softer thing is willing to relinquish some measure of contingency so the softer thing can come even temporarily to rest, and if a test were devised on the subject of this lesson, then what would be gained for one who took this test and passed it, or one who took this test and failed? Letter to Ignatz. O my dear devoir, O my dour devour. Your name, an arrow with a rope attached, could pull this raft across this river. O bring me my ordinary, my trays of soot and sand, for tonight I am a window in a cottage by the sea. O mia paloma blanca, O my desert dune, my dove, who now will sing the praises of a natural love? The Wedding of Ignatz. Wait is the end of wanting, the simples gleaming in their rests. In the game called hypothesis, an orange is gripped between the chin and shoulder, then is transferred with care and laughing to the chin and shoulder of the next in line. Then a flaming log is rolled into the river. Then a chalk circle is drawn around each plate. One day I walked to the window, robed in the loveliest robe of the year. One day I knelt down by the fountain, a crown of parsley, a crown of dill. One day my hands closed on the handles, a match tip was placed beneath my tongue. Listen to me, someone has tricked you. There never was an apple. Ignatz Domesticus. Then one day she noticed the forest had started to bleed into her waking life. There were curved metal plates on the trees to see around corners. She thought to brush her hand against his thigh. She thought to trace the seam of his jeans with her thumbnail. The supersaturated blues were beginning to pixelate around the edges to become a kind of grammar. Soot amassed in drifts in the corners of the room. A soft brown dot loomed large in her concern. She pressed her thumb into the hollow of his throat for a while and then let him go. Invisible Ignatz. I would forget you were it not that unseen flutes keep whistling the curving phrases of your body. Winged Ignatz. As Jim mentioned, Crazy's pet nickname for Ignatz is a little angel. Winged Ignatz. There are 27 feathers. There are 15 feathers on the right shoulder blade, 12 on the left, curving outwards, then streaming down the back. When I say feathers, I mean to say lines, undulating lines, more like hair than like feathers, since unlike feathers, these lines do not convey a ruched or corrugated effect, as might be rendered by layered tiers of scallops or by a fingered edge. Instead of lines, I might more precisely have said cuts, discontinuous cuts dotted with blood clots. Flinches cluster at the clots like mayflies, as one imagines the blade snagging in the skin where the cuts cross one another. Mayflies, too, are winged, but no one wants them, unless to convey a sense of the ephemeral, a fan of surface scratches that splay across the shoulders but do not break the skin, merely exhortatory, inviting one to read the underlying cuts as dimensional, on the verge of lifting out of the skin, unfurling above the shoulders, lines of blood fleshing themselves, then feathering themselves, in strength and mass, rivaling the body, muscle-bound, that submitted to give them birth. Ignatz, pop quiz. Question one. A tetherball is swinging in a horizontal circle around a pole attached with a 2-meter-long massless rope. Question two. Tell me when you can feel this. This one's a little, it's a form called a villanelle, which I always think of as being kind of like one of those little cuckoo clocks they have at Disneyland where you have all of the characters just constantly going around and around doing the little things that they do. So it's sort of the story in miniature. Ignatz, oh, I should also mention, a panegyrist in some traditions is somebody whose job it is to walk backwards in front of the emperor in processions, constantly singing the praises of the emperor, which, you know, I thought was kind of a nice thing. Ignatz, a desert waltz. The panegyrist beneath a parasol sings of Ignatz, blackguard, bandit, and bane. in flies betrayal on ultra suede wings. His target selected, so feckless he flings a lethal love missile with unerring aim. The panegyrist beneath a parasol sings. A Rube Goldberg contraption of widgets and springs makes mechanical love no volition, no blame. In flies betrayal on ultra suede wings. In Coconino Cathedral, a silver bell rings. Robed in white cambric, his love waits in vain. The panegyrist beneath a parasol sings. She fled to the desert. In her wanderings, she dreamt that you summoned the life-giving rain. In flies betrayal on ultra suede wings. The lithium waters of Sahuaro Springs know amour analgesic, no solvent for shame. The panegyrist beneath a parasol sings. In flies betrayal on ultra suede wings. And then since it's a modular strip, each of the four sections of the book ends with a death, the death of Ignatz. Fallow lies Ignatz, his salt hands helplessly wicking moisture from the air. The death of Ignatz. The mesas sink to their knees and let the snickering dunes crawl over them. The death of Ignatz. Scratched in the plexi of the defunct jukebox. God, I was such a simple song. The death of Ignatz. The architect leapt from the bright bell tower, and the sea slunk back to her cage. Thank you very much.
Okay. Can you hear me okay? Yeah, okay, we've switched microphones successfully. Good evening. Thank you all so much for coming out, and a special thank you to Jim Hoberman and Monica Yoon for coming out and doing this tonight. I'm Megan O'Rourke. I'm one of the poetry editors at the Paris Review, where we were lucky enough to publish Monica's poems. And I just wanted to start our conversation by asking, you know, Jim, as you were saying, this Crazy Cat began in what would seem to be the most ephemeral of places. You know, it's a disposable weekly series. If you had asked somebody 90 years ago what might become part of the enduring literature, perhaps a, you know, Sunday serial about a cat, a dog, and a mouse wouldn't have been it. So in your views, what has made Crazy Cat endure? I'd love to hear from each of you.
Well, I think that Harriman came up with a very simple formula that's not really reducible. You can't turn Crazy Cat easily into an allegory. It's itself. It's the same story that Harriman keeps telling, and I think that the cumulative power of that is what sustained it.
Marco?
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's the simplicity of the story and the way in which it's... I mean, I think Harriman... I don't know very much about comic history, but when I think about the essence of the comic strip, I think of something that's modular, where you have character development that is static rather than dynamic. You know, like Charlie Brown never gets to kick the football. We just have the same situation repeating itself, and each time you get another take on the identical situation. I think of... You know, Harriman's the simplicity of this story is, I guess, what drew me to it anyways.
Well, I was wondering if there's also, that makes a lot of sense to me having seen these, but it also seems that there's something kind of open-ended about how we interpret, how we relate to Crazy Cat, and I just wanted to read very briefly something that E. Cummings wrote in the introduction that you talked about, Jim. He says of Crazy Cat, "But if both our hero and our villain, both Ignatz and Officer Pup, don't and can't understand our heroine, each of them can and each of them does misunderstand her differently. To our soft-hearted altruist, she is the adorably helpless incarnation of saintliness. To our hard-hearted egoist, she is the puzzlingly indestructible embodiment of idiocy." And, you know, it is so striking watching that. You know, you look at that and you think, well, is that, you know, to be admired or feared?
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that's really notable about Crazy Cat is how many artists and writers alike, from Picasso to E.E. Cummings to Jay Cantor, have, and to Monica Yoon now, have drawn on Crazy Cat as a source for later work. And I'm wondering... you know, again, why that might be, what makes it such a flexibly adaptable form. And maybe, Monica, you could talk about what drew you to Crazy Cat.
Well, I think it's, you know, it's so charming and so light, but the themes that it deals with are actually kind of dark if you take a moment to think about them. It has to do with repetitive activity, with obsession, with this need for closure, and, you know, the way in which, you know, the punchline has to happen every time, and, you know, how that relates to both to art and to obsession. But the way in which it's done just doesn't drill that into your head. It's very light and very glancing. So it's kind of, you know, when I was writing these, I thought about Stevens's 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird and how every take on that just gets weirder and weirder until, you know, you're like at the O Thin Men of Haddam and you're like, what are we talking about here? You know, I thought we were talking about blackbirds. But it's an interesting way in which you're able to... By focusing on one subject, you're able to get this sort of lightness.
And just to follow up there, I mean, what was it like to take something that was originally both visual and linguistic, that had both components, and to try to translate it into words? Did you feel, as you were writing, the absence of the visual, or did you feel that the visual began to inform your process even more than it might normally?
I mean, I tried to think about the visual more structurally, I guess, in terms of the way in which the book is modular and reads in certain ways. I mean, it's hard to translate something as deft as Harriman's line. And I actually found the Harriman's language to be more of a barrier because, you know, he does come up with this brilliant, you know, kind of punning patois that's deeply alliterative and deeply... deeply referential, and you know, I was like, if I try to do that, then I'm just going to be doing the whole book in this kind of imitation, and I that's not why I did this. So I'm going to just ignore that, pretend it didn't happen, and you know, write this in my own way.
Yeah, it's funny. The language reminds me almost, you know, the poet who actually seems to be doing something most similar in terms of language is a poet like John Berryman and the Dream Songs. Yeah. And I was wondering, Jim, you talked a lot about slapstick, but not about vaudeville. And I was wondering if vaudeville had informed this strip to your knowledge, and if so, how?
Well, I think that certainly in terms of the way that Crazy Cat speaks, and, right. and even all of them, they have this very sort of theatrical deliveries that would have been part of it, but the dynamism of it and the brutality, I think, comes out of slapstick and something that you know, in terms of why artists would have picked up on this and been drawn to it, I think is what one of the things you were saying, Monica, is that it's people must have been amazed. I mean, first of all, to find this, to come across this in the newspaper, even if, you know, you had somebody telling them about it. And then, you know, there was no cult of Crazy Cat except that cult which was discovering it for the first time. And it must have been phenomenal for people to pick up on it day after day and watch what this guy was doing. The fact that he was able to charged up to be able just to sustain this level of interest. I mean, in his own obsession. I mean, the characters are obsessed, but he obviously had a powerful obsession as well. And you know, the fact that it was expected and completely unexpected at the same time would have been a source of its, you know, appeal.
Yeah, and you were saying this was really interesting, and some of the pieces I was reading about Crazy Cat before talked about this too, that the idea of the comic as a strip was relatively new. And both of you have been talking about this fact of that the form is something that wasn't static, but it wasn't yet film. You know, film is becoming popular at this time. And I wonder if, Jim, maybe you could talk a little bit about that idea of the strip. And it itself seems like a hybrid at that moment, you know.
Well, there's a strong connection
between
between comic strips and movies. I mean, they both develop in the 1890s. The first newspaper comics don't really have that strip format, and you have to wonder if that was something that came as a result of a movie. Certainly later on, the comic book artists are really, you know, very influenced by what they see at the movies. But I think, you know, in this period of Crazy Cat, it's just this, you know, it's part of its modernity that there could be this time space continuum just laid out there on the page.
Yeah, and I wonder if part of the modernity too is that it seems to be a sequence, but it's not, as you've both been talking about, it's a sequence that's not a sequence, and it seems quite almost avant-garde in that sense, that just as people are figuring out, oh, here's how we can develop narrative, it seems to be repudiating narrative too.
Yeah, and there are certain, I mean, in terms of Harriman, we didn't say there are certain conventions which are established, which then he plays with throughout. Couldn't find any of these incredible Sunday pages where there are some maybe you've seen them where the panels are all at an angle, or they, you know, he just, you know, completely keeps inventing different ways to fill the page.
I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit more about that, because I don't know a lot about the conventions of the comic strip. But so on the Sunday pages, traditionally there was a pretty set in stone layout, and then during other days it wasn't.
Well, the daily pages is where you had the strip, where you basically had four or five panels, and then the Sunday pages, there'd be a supplement in color, usually, and that was what sold the newspaper, and you know, fantastically elaborate things. I mean, Little Nemo being the you know, the most, you know, such a surplus of energy going into this, you know, Winsor McKay's strip. But so the Sunday ones are different. Some of the narrative ones, like the whole week's narrative, would be recapitulated on Sunday. But for somebody like Harriman, he just, you know, did something different each time.
And it often wasn't linear. Like, he would sometimes have things that would, like, read in a circle, and you would, you know, he was very much interested in the kind of formal constraint of linearity and of trying to subvert that whenever he could. I mean, Jim had mentioned the ways in which, even though a story appears to be sequential and happening in real time, that the backgrounds are changing and it's going from day to night and day to, you know,
that was one of the weirdest things.
Yeah. He plays with that a lot.
Which you know, in a way that's cinematic, but that's something that no filmmaker, you know, of this period would ever dream of doing something like that.
Something as radical as that,
exactly.
Constant shifting.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to sort of backpedal for a moment and ask you both, what was your first encounter with Crazy Cat? I mean, do you remember it, and can you sort of recapture some of that for us?
Oh, I think I was visiting a friend of mine who may actually be in the audience in Tucson, and having one of these, had just broken up with a boy, and was having one of these go to the desert and hike in the desert and fast sort of, you know, times. And, you know,
hopefully came not get hit by a brick.
Exactly. Yeah. Came across this book, and with the combination of fasting and reading this book, I think, just made me think, oh, I could write one of these. And then I thought, well, I could probably write another. And then I was like, well, maybe I'll do like a series of five of them. And then five became 15, and then 15 became 50, and, you know, just became a whole book. So
was it partly the theme of love and sort of the confusions of love, the profound, the way it's a metaphor for how we misunderstand those, that drew you to it?
Yeah, sort of. We're not really a metaphor, but it's just so interesting having this this figure, this cipher. Like, Ignatz is really, he's four kind of teardrop shapes. He's like two ears, a head, and a body. I mean, that's really all he is. And that so much meaning can be projected onto this cipher was interesting to me. And that the cipher, you know, part of the power of a cipher is that it can work in so many contexts. You know, you can place an object against a series of backdrops and see how that object relates to the backdrop.
Jim?
Well, I was trying to think of this myself, actually, when I was preparing. And I realized that before I had encountered Crazy Cat, I had come across Harriman's drawings, because I had, when I was a kid, I'd been given a copy of Archie and Mehitabel. And the drawings, actually, which, is they're kind of poems, or there are poems in there, and the drawings made a much stronger impression on me. And of course, Mehitabel is a cat with very different personality than Crazy. But there was something about these drawings which, to me as a kid, seemed, I mean, very primitive. I mean, I knew that, you know, this, and in fact, almost bad drawing, and that at the same time it was so incredibly expressive. And to me, that's the, you know, one of the miraculous things about this strip is you describe Ignatz. He's not there, but there's so much intensity of emotion in Ignatz, who's barely present. And you know, how does that happen? I mean, that was what struck me.
You know, I was reading about the various films that have been made, and you know, one of the common critiques was that studios got too involved and said and wanted to kind of normalize or create a more normative Crazy Cat in Ignatz. But as you're speaking, it strikes me, I mean, do you think it was possible to make a Crazy Cat film that would have been as evocative as the strip?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you get a little hint of it. I mean, his style does translate, I think, onto the screen. But whether it could have been as as radical in its form, I wonder.
Yeah, I think you could get some nice sense of the movement, but the really kind of the avant-garde part of it, I think, would be lost.
Yeah, because it almost seems that it's partly the defeat of motion that is part of how. It's another one of the ways that this is a cipher, that, you know, you're kind of, there's always this forward narrative motion that is got blank spaces around it.
Yeah, and frozen also. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many of them end with it's like this moment out of time.
Jim, in your talk, you spoke about the fact that George Harriman was born to a Creole colored family and had passed for some time, and I just wondered whether either of you had anything to say about that and the role that has in the strip, whether you feel that there's... In one of the strips you showed us about Crazy Cat coming out dressed in white and now Ignatz loves Crazy Cat, it was hard not to see some kind of sociocultural critique embedded in that. And
well, I think that it's... this is something that actually, you know, was discovered relatively recently. I mean, years after Harriman died, somebody went and did the research in New Orleans, you know, found his birth certificate, and that he was marked colored on his birth certificate, and then that his parents were classified as mulatto. So, you know, you can't not see this as something that's contributing to the strip and also, you know, just making it all the more kind of quintessentially American too, this would have been his background. But like every other attempt, I think to allegorize it, it defeats a kind of easy reading.
Yeah, he's playing around with that idea. I mean, the Coconino County that he creates is kind of this multicultural cast of characters with, like, this Chinese duck and this, like, Mexican coyote and this French poodle and, you know. But the sort of language that they speak is almost like, you know, Esperanto. It's got little bits of French and German and Spanish mixed in all the time. But he's, you know, again, he's not trying to hammer anything home. He's just kind of playing around with the idea.
Well, I go back to that word improvisation that you were using, and that seems so important here, that there's you keep using the word lightness, Monica, and it does seem that there's a resistance in the way that much postmodern work might, too, sort of resist too much over-interpretation of an allegory or a theme. We talked a lot about Ignatz and Crazy Cat, but not a lot about Office of Pup, and sort of I was curious about how that figure... how that figure embodies authority and sort of the comedy of authority, and whether we just might hear a little more about poor Office of Pup.
It's like the least interesting
figure,
I think, in the triangle. Well, but certainly, I mean, there are two. I mean, he, you know, there's everybody, you know, is being propelled by their emotions that they really don't understand, and his, I guess, would be the most have the greatest social use value, that he's he wants to keep law and order. What's interesting to me is that how little effect this has on Crazy one way or the other.
Yeah, it's funny because Crazy is always Officer Pup wants nothing more than to protect Crazy, and Crazy is always climbing out the window trying to escape from Officer Pup so she can meet Ignatz and get hit in the head by a brick.
Yeah.
So it's
anarchy wins.
Yeah, exactly.
What else did I want to ask you? What do you have a particular period that's a favorite period, or is part of the function of the repetition that there's not a single time that stands out?
Well, I think I like this. I like the Sunday pages because then you really get this kind of graphic invention, and to a certain degree, Harriman was, I think, hostage to stuff that was going on with the formats in these Sunday supplements, so that at some periods he's much freer than others to experiment with it.
I mean, I think it's fun when he does have the I guess some of the Sunday pages are laid out kind of 1, 2, 3 in a 3x3 grid. And the middle bit is always kind of funny to me because I guess some of the papers would print an advertisement in that middle square and some would not. So the middle square was kind of this optional thing, and he would often have this little self-contained vignette of the entire story in the middle square, which could be taken out if the paper wanted to print an ad there, which is funny.
Evidently, there were periods when there was only one newspaper in Seattle that was carrying the Sunday page.
And was he able to make a living from doing this? Was this what he mainly did? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there was. Great. Well, I think we're going to open it up to the audience. If you have questions, I know there are going to be microphones going up and down the aisles.
When did he do the drawings for Archie and Mehitabel, which is a far more sophisticated story than anything here? Was that prior to forming the Crazy Cat things?
I don't know whether he did the Archie Mehitabel was a column that ran in the New York Sun, I guess in the 20s into the 30s. I'm not exactly sure. I think what happened was when the columns were collected, he was hired by the publisher to illustrate them. I'm not absolutely certain of that, but that's my guess. I don't think that he and Don Markey's worked together when the columns were being written.
And my other question is, really, don't you think that the repetitive simplicity of the Crazy Cat stories are actually an indication of the lack of sophistication of the American public?
No. No, and I'll say that I think that it's hard to know what the public made of this. I mean, you can't really there were people who wrote about it, but what's amazing to me about this, and also about Winsor McCay and other comic strip artists of this period, is how much they put into it. It's something that was so ephemeral. I mean, it wouldn't be polite for me to say how people who write for newspapers describe what happens to a newspaper the next day, but the fact is that who was he really working for? Who were people? Him and Winsor McCay. Who were they working for? I mean, it's not as if they were giving their audience, I feel, so much more than the audience ever would have expected.
Hi. I have a question about the relationship it's a two-part question. One would be, the first part of the question is there any evidence that there was a consciousness on Hearst's part in terms of his patronage that had more to do with simply the fact that he thought this was really funny? Did he see this as an avant-garde thing? Did he see this as somehow either subversive or important in, with a capital I?
I don't know. I don't think there's much evidence of Hearst being a champion of
Except he just didn't cancel it, I guess.
Oh, I think he liked it. I mean, you know, maybe he appreciated it as a journalist. I mean, the fact that somebody could just do these continuous variations.
And the related second question would be: Do you know if they had a personal relationship? Were they friends? Did they meet at different points in their lives, or did they ever meet?
I'm sure, you know, Mr. Hearst came at some point, you know, to the various newspapers, and maybe the staff was gathered together. I don't know. I'm just guessing that over 30 years, maybe they met.
Yeah. Okay. Do you know also? Let me stick one in here real fast. Do you know? can you say, like, in terms of the way the animated bit we saw, how much has deteriorated since the day it came out? I mean, would this look even remotely like what it would have looked like in 1916, what it would have debuted?
Well, given the fact that what we saw was a 16-millimeter print that, you know, was probably third or fourth generation, mm-hmm. it would have been much bigger and brighter, and the contrast would have been mm-hmm. would have been more apparent. But it's very kind of elemental animation, so it's not as if I think the details were lost particularly.
Okay, thanks.
Any more questions? I think we have one in the back there.
Mm-hmm. Do you see any of his character designs repeated in contemporary comics characters, as far as just the way they're drawn?
You know, there was an underground cartoonist who did a lot of posters for the Fillmore in San Francisco in the 70s, Victor Moscoso, who did his version of Crazy Cat. But it looked kind of, I mean, he used space in a different way, and he alluded to it. I think this it would probably be an impossible style for anybody to copy that. I mean, you know, it's like a signature.
I have a question. Was the triangle in place from the very beginning, or were the early ones more about the relationship between Ignatz and Crazy Cat, as we saw in the film, for example? Or do you have a sense
Well,
of that?
When they started in with the Dingbat family, mm-hmm. I think that the premise was that the mouse was afraid of the cat or something like that. I mean, it was you know, so he was playing around with it. I don't know. But he must have come across it very early. But do you know?
Yeah, I mean, my impression was the mouse was much more of an innocent character in those ones where it appears really at the very bottom of the frame.
It's interesting because in an essay, there's a wonderful essay Stanley Crouch wrote about the Crazy Cat. And in it he wrote, "Everything natural is messed up. The dog loves the cat loves the mouse." And he put natural, of course, in quotation marks, which seems to me to be an important part of the series, too. And Monica, I was wondering, you know, as you were writing, was that part of what was appealing? Was that in a weird way it kind of destabilizes all of the categories from the beginning, yet gives you ciphers to work with?
I don't know if I was thinking about it in that, you know, I don't know if that thought was particularly apparent to me. I mean, I was more thinking about just like destabilization in terms of having, you know, having something that's modular rather than linear. But,
What do you think about his coyness about, you know, the cat's gender?
Yeah, that's always been a little bit strange to me. I mean, he's often, I think it's just because he wants to be able to get maximum mileage out of the character, so you can both have, you know, Crazy being in love with Ignatz, and Ignatz is married and has little mice children, apparently. And but you can also have, you know, Crazy go crazy for a French poodle, and to have Crazy competing with Ignatz for the affections of this French poodle or whatever. It just makes it makes Crazy a more versatile character, I guess.
Yeah, it works with the fluidity of other things.
Yeah.
In the strip, but I mean, it's hard not to assign. I mean, you know, you have to, you know, catch yourself from referring to Crazy as she.
Yeah,
yeah. Do you find that you think of Crazy as a as she?
Yeah,
generally?
I do.
Yes.
But
yeah, I mostly do.
You mostly do. Yeah, I couldn't decide. I didn't actually feel like I had a relationship of gender to Crazy. But
there was this terrible film version of it. That animation that was done in color in I guess maybe the 60s or something.
Yeah, for TV. Yeah.
And it had given Crazy just this real kind of Mae West kind of voice, like Ignatz. It was just awful. You know, just. Doing a lot of batting her eyes and stuff. It was terrible.
Well, this is a terrible comparison, but it was making me think about that film WALL-E that came out this summer and how one couldn't help but start to assign gender to WALL-E and Eva. And part of it was the voice, but there was no real reason that we should have assumed either was male or female except for... And this seems similarly, again, trying to be quite open-ended, much more consciously trying to be open-ended about gender. Any questions before? Yes, we have one back there.
I just got a quick one about the environment that this is taking place in.
It sort of blows my mind that It sort of blows my mind that he was writing this in like the teens and the 20s. You know, because the background to me is so like psychedelic, essentially. You know, and like hallucinatory almost. Did he just sort of pull that like from his subconscious or something, or was he just sort of doodling in the background, do you guys think? Or and then like a little sub question, like Megan, did that have any effect on like the way you were writing the poems?
The easiest thing to say is that, you know, he was a genius and he just did what he did. I don't, you know, certainly wasn't somebody who seems to have written much about or given interviews on why he made certain decisions. But.
And I think a lot of the landscape out there in Arizona is kind of psychedelic. I mean, you're right on the edge of the painted desert with Monument Valley, and occasionally some of the things are recognizable. But I mean, what I mostly took from the background in terms of writing is this sort of shifting, which, again, we've talked about. But in a comic strip, you can do this thing where you have this love triangle, and all of a sudden the next strip can be set in ancient Egypt. And you don't have to explain, oh, now we're the same characters doing the same thing in ancient Egypt or, you know, on a pirate ship or whatever. You can just switch it, and that's a convention that people just swallow. I mean, there's no discussion of it. It's something that you barely even notice, whereas if that were done in any other art form, it would be shocking. So I was, you know, trying to take advantage of that by making the angles, I guess, from which I was viewing the subject as disparate as I could.
Any more questions? We have another one here.
I just wondered whether either of you keeps up with any current comic strips, and if so, which ones?
You mean comic strips?
Cartoons or comic strips, whether it's on the internet or... Or on television, even The Simpsons.
I was up late last night reading all of the campaign footage from Get Your War On, which I think is kind of similarly brilliant in its just complete deadpan cipher.
Do you want to describe what that? I mean,
I don't know very much. I mean, it's something I find. You know, I got the book, I guess, after September 11th. But it's this cartoonist who really uses the most banal. Clip art images.
His name
of
is David Reese.
Of kind of office workers and, you know, office supplies, and it's always the particular campaign series of Get Your War On is always the same black man who is accounts receivable calling the same white man who is accounts payable, and it's brilliant. There's just this kind of, I mean, it's. You know, it's very politically incorrect, but it says a lot of very smart things about race and the campaign that are kind of great.
I like to look at Chris Ware's stuff, and I would say that the cartoonist who I wish he was in the newspaper every day is Ben Katcher, who I think is able to sustain a certain kind of world, you know, that just, in fact... If you're familiar with Ben Katcher's early comics, you know, the Julius Knipple ones. I mean, there are parts of New York which just seem to me now to have been invented by Ben Katcher. And sometimes you know, around the Flower District, you just walk into Ben Katcher's world from time to time.
I had a question for Monica about the language of Crazy Cat and its influence on you. One thing I noticed, there's a book that's sort of the biography or history of Crazy Cat, and they have some letters from Harriman in there, and they read it reads like a five-year-old fighting bees. Like, he can't write in a conventional way at all. He is sort of a savant in terms of having this ingenious patois that he's come up with and that he's completely comfortable with coming up with all these different characters with, but he's not someone who, you know, would be comfortable in various realms of discourse. And it seems like there's sort of two types of artists a lot of times, ones that sort of have that, and then you're an attorney or someone who's probably broadly competent in various sort of discourse realms. But in terms of trying to come up with sort of a style of writing these poems, I mean, that is a totally different mindset, even, I mean, beyond the qualitative, you don't want to write in his particular style. But did you find it difficult to, I guess, that element, that sort of savantish element, to try to incorporate that however abstractly, or was that a consideration?
Yeah, no, that was definitely a challenge, to try to do something that was interesting with the language without having a slavish imitation of what he was doing, and trying to incorporate a lot of the, both the visual and the oral rhymes and alliteration that he uses, just to have a lot of repeating elements go throughout the book, a lot of kind of sound plays, a lot of that sort of thing. And I do think that, you know, it must have been interesting for him, because imagine doing this every day for 30 years, writing these strips in this kind of patois. It must have become a language that he was almost as comfortable with as, you know, he would have been writing it in English. And I guess you alluded to my work as a lawyer. The way lawyers use language is this weird kind of, you know, it's this weird deployment of little power nuggets of language, like, you know, cruel and unusual punishment or due process of law. And it's not really this kind of easy, fluid thing necessarily. And so, you know, I think about the way in which the language gets kind of compacted and difficult and reads in backwards and forwards in law, and the way that happens in poetry as well.
Close analysis in both, though.
Yeah, no.
And do you sometimes fear that you are internalizing the language of law as
he
might have internalized
the
language of
all the time? Especially when I talk to my family. Yeah.
Any other questions? All right, well, Monica and Jim, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you all so much for joining us.